Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, here by myself this week to introduce our newest podcast episode. We have a new online exhibition that is currently running on our website, alhirschfeldfoundation.org, and it's called Lost in the Stars, Black Theater Makers Drawn by Hirschfeld. We at the Al Hirschfeld Foundation believe that Black lives matter, Black art matters, and of course, Black theater matters. And so for this episode, we talk to Ben West. Ben is a musical theater artist and historian. He is a curator for the forthcoming Museum of Broadway in Times Square, and his book, The American Musical, A Comprehensive History of the Art Form, will be published by Routledge in 2022. He has worked in various capacities on Broadway, off-Broadway, and regionally. His work has also been seen in Lincoln Center's American Songbook series. West has lectured and spoken at several institutions, including the Library of Congress, Yale, and the New York Public Library. He is a recipient of Lincoln Center's Martin E. Segal Award. Ben obviously has great passion for the American musical, as we all do here at the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, and I'm sure as all of our listeners do as well. Before we get into it, I want to please remind everybody to follow along in the show notes as we're talking about the drawings. Important for this podcast as well, since it's our online exhibition, you can go just straight to that link, which will be the first link in the show notes, to the exhibition. And for the most part, if I remember correctly, you should be able to follow along pretty much in order. We don't go over all the drawings that are in the exhibition, so definitely check it out. And a final friendly reminder, don't forget to follow us on social media, Facebook, the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, Twitter, and Instagram, at Al Hirschfeld. Enjoy the show.
Today, we are talking to Ben West, a musical theater historian who's literally rewriting the book today of what the American musical is, was, is, and will be, perhaps. But he's really filling in a lot of information that has been missing in most standard narratives about the American musical. Really shining a light also on the Black composers, performers, designers, directors who played a really crucial role in the development of the American musical, but have been written out of its history, as well as the women and really all people of color. He is really helping us to understand all the non-white men who helped create the American musical. And I think that's going to be, that is a needed readjustment of what we know about the American musical. So Ben, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for asking me.
This podcast is devoted to our new online exhibition, Lost in the Stars, Black Theater Makers Drawn by Hirschfeld. And it covers a 72-year period. As I write in the intro to the exhibition, Black actors, directors, composers, lyricists, playwrights, designers, and producers have long played a role in the American theater, despite the inherent racism on the Great White Way. From the start in minstrel shows of the 19th century, Black artists have suffered underrepresentation both on and off stage in America. The title of this exhibition comes from the musical of the same name that explored the racial injustices of the 20th century South Africa apartheid system, but it can also serve as a metaphor of the Black creative in a predominantly white theater world. Too often the contributions of Black artists have been minimized or co-opted, and the Al Hirschfeld Foundation wants to celebrate many of the Black stars in all disciplines that make the American theater what it is today. So in this exhibition, we've brought together 26 images that cover 72 years of theater history and the Black theater makers who made it. They are not the only drawings that Hirschfeld did. Curating is as much about what you leave out as what you put in. And there are at least three times as many other drawings we could have used for this exhibition. We tried to find ones that you might be familiar with, as well as ones you've never heard about. And certainly I think a lot of these performers and productions you might not have heard about. And that's why we have brought Ben on the show. We're gonna start at the beginning.
We're gonna start with one of my favorite drawings.
If you listen one to the of your favorite?
One of my top five favorite drawings, but probably number two, We're starting in 1927 with Rang Tang.
This is Hirschfeld's very first drawing of a Black performer.
Two Black.
Which just blew my mind. Two Black performers. And that is amazing because he's been working first in the film industry and then drawing theater since 1920. He had been drawing the theater for less than a year when this drawing appeared, but it took that long to get a Black performer in a newspaper drawn by Hirschfeld. So Miller and Lyles, which have long fascinated us, Ben, what can you tell us about them?
Sure. Well, Miller and Lyles are probably most famous for the 1921 Black musical Shuffle Along,
sure,
which I think most people have are familiar with or have a passing familiarity, which was instrumental in launching the myriad of Black musicals that came on the scene during the 1920s, instrumental in terms of the Harlem Renaissance, just an all-around momentous piece, Shuffle Along. And Miller and Lyles were two of the four gentlemen that created that piece, the other two being Noble Sissel and U.B. Blake. But Miller and Lyles fascinate me as well, I will say, because they, in terms of the history of Black theater, Black musical theater specifically, there is this overlooked period pre-Shuffle Along that is really completely forgotten. And this is essentially the very end of the 19th century, so late 1800s, through around 1910. That's where I personally cut it off for a number of reasons. But this basically, 10, 12 years has a tremendous amount of activity. Burt Williams is working in this period. And that's, I think, one name that people remember.
Now he was a Black performer who performed in blackface.
He did perform in blackface, exactly. Yeah. As did Miller and Lyles, actually.
Oh, wow.
And of course, Burt Williams became especially famous. He was well known prior to that for his partnership with George Walker, but he became especially well known when he went into the Ziegfeld Follies.
Sure.
In 1910. So in this early period, it was primarily dominated by performer/writers, and four of them in particular. Ernest Hogan, who is, I think, a name that we don't really remember today, or I should say most people don't really remember today, but was very instrumental in terms of the changing musical sounds, both ragtime and then its counterpart at the time, coon songs, which was this period circa 1900, this group of songs called coon songs, which was came about and went hand in hand with ragtime.
Are those ethnic comedy songs like the Italian songs or the Jewish songs or the Dutch songs? Are we speaking that type of thing?
In essence, yes. Yeah. I will say I'm not familiar with the Italian I'm not intimately familiar with the Italian to the extent the Jewish songs of the early 1900s. There are some kind of outrageous and in some cases delicious pieces by one of my favorite writers. I should say favorite writers, but a little known writer that I'm fond of named Will J. Harris, who actually played a Jewish character in this vaudeville unit out of Chicago.
Okay.
So I'm tangentially familiar with those. So I don't want to make a strict comparison because I'm not, I don't have a firm grasp on the other ethnic songs. But coon songs, I would imagine, were similar to that. And then, of course, I think, on top of that, with the racial dynamics of our country, there was an added sting in terms of what they were, or ultimately what they did as a byproduct, because they were created coon songs as comedy pieces for the music hall, is my understanding and how they were talked about at the time, and widely sung.
Is this an outgrowth of the minstrel show?
Not specifically, I would say. I mean, and I would say not a direct outgrowth, an outgrowth in the sense that it was an extension of that sound, you know, so it's
sure.
Coming off of, or coming with Ragtime, which is an extension of plantation songs and minstrel songs. But it did, they didn't directly result because of the minstrel show.
Okay.
But they were intended to be these comedy pieces, which then only went to further the narrative of black people being subhuman, or these non-human caricatures of what, you know, watermelon, chicken, and so it was, you know, a very harsh, and ultimately what became a demeaning stereotype that ended up persisting. So it's that double-edged sword where it actually offered opportunity for black writers, because then you had people like Ernest Hogan, you had Bob Cole, to an extent Williams and Walker actually, writing coon songs, Gussie Davis. So there was opportunity, you know, a door opened for them, but it was in this field where it was essentially putting down their own character in something that was meant to be funny, but then just, you know, ended up, being quite severe and harmful. Yeah, exactly. But in any case, so this early period of black musical theater, Bob Cole was very prominent. I refer to him as the father of black musical theater. He and his partners, the Johnson brothers, were actually, you know, incredibly successful writing musicals for white Broadway, as it were. They wrote several interpolations for white musicals. They actually wrote a full white musical, the score, I should say.
And the Johnson brothers wrote Lift Every Voice?
Exactly right, yes, yeah. Yes. Rosamund Johnson and James Weldon Johnson. And to tie this into something we're going to discuss later, I just found out that Canada Lee, who is in some of the drawings to be discussed later, studied violin with Rosamund Johnson.
No kidding.
So that's sort of like a interesting bridge, you know. But in any case, so this early period, Bob Cole, the Johnson brothers, and Williams and Walker, Ernest Hogan, who I mentioned earlier, not as well known as Williams and Walker, his last show in this period is in comes about in 1907. And the book for that show is written by Miller and Lyles. There is, to sort of bring it back home, they're especially interesting because they bridge this gap between this first rich era of black musical theater, which ends around 1910. And then the black musical stage is not dormant, but it doesn't have the prominence that it had during the early part. During the teens, it's, you know, sort of absent to an extent, while the sounds are changing offstage. And Miller and Lyles are sort of looked upon during that era as, based on writings that I've read, are looked upon as sort of the folks who are going to lead us back into prominence, lead the black musical theater back into prominence. There's a specific show that they were referring, that critics and press and commentators were referring to, called Darkiedom, which was circa 1915, which didn't land on Broadway, and it didn't make any type of substantial mark. But, you know, 6 years later, Miller and Lyles would make a substantial mark with Shuffle Along, and then really be very present throughout the rest of the 1920s and into the early 30s until Aubrey Lyles' death in 1932.
Do you know anything about Rang? Can you tell us anything about Rang Tang specifically, or no?
Rang Tang specifically. Yeah. It got a mix of favorable reviews and seemed to be a sort of a general black musical product of the 20s, which is to say basically a review that in some cases had a thin thread of story. I think in most of the cases with Miller and Lyles, they were playing the same characters that they generally played, because this is,
right.
They, you know, they, like many artists at the time, they grew up in vaudeville,
right.
Which is
right.
One of my favorite stage forms. It is not you know, vaudeville is not a theatrical piece, you know, it's not a musical piece, but it is a cousin of the stage, essentially. And so they, you know, they excelled in vaudeville, continued in vaudeville till the end of their, you know, run together. And so I feel like their stage shows were sort of extensions of that. It seems to me, because certainly they had the same names for, I think, either most or all of their pieces in the 20s in terms of character names.
Right.
I think of that variety.
And it's true that most musicals of that period, you know, nobody revives those because the books are ridiculous. You know,
right,
running through all of those. I mean, really,
if at all.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it is until Showboat, same year, that we get a libretto that's worth sort of doing again or making sense of.
I wouldn't be as definitive as that. I mean, just personal view.
That's a simplification.
In terms of Black musicals, I think specifically there was not, they were of the revue variety, and most people expected, and I think Black artists fed into that expectation. Most people expected basically hot jazz and dancing. Right. And so, and sort of broad comedy. Right. And so I think they, for better or worse, I mean, many wonderful things and wonderful artists came out of it. But the shows also then were pigeonholed or put in this box, you know, and there's, it's not in this exact period, but the a number of years later, Brooks, I'm going to totally butcher this quote, but Brooks Atkinson, who a major New York Times critic, talks about how Negro intellectuals claim it's white audiences that expect this standardized routine from Black musicals. And then he points out that that's not in fact the case, or not in fact the entire case, because you have theaters in Harlem, like the Lafayette, or later the Apollo, which started doing tab reviews, producing these shows, whereas he put it, you know, that wind up in the jungle with hot girls and you know, skinny girls in hot costumes, dancing, hot routines, some variety of that. I'm butchering the actual quote, but that's the sentiment of it. So, you know, it was not just white audiences demanding this or expecting that. I mean, it was also Black artists delivering it and writing it for themselves, you know, in many cases, when you look up at the, especially the Donald Hayward shows up at the Lafayette and the Apollo. I think outside of Black musicals, it's not often talked about, which is one of the things I'm addressing in the book, but there were actually many, many shows with strong, albeit primitive, librettos pre-Showboat. One specifically being, I think one I would point to just right away, are either the Princess musicals from 15 to 17 to 18, and then also what we now would consider it an operetta, but really it was basically a play, and it had this tinge of Oscar Hammerstein cynicism in it, which I find very interesting.
Wow.
Again, you know, the actual text is more surface level than what we would get when we start getting into Hammerstein. But the show is Maytime, 1917, by Sigmund Romberg and Rita Johnson Young, actually based on a German musical comedy. But my point being, I in my view, there did exist, you know, strong.
Oh yes.
Libretto.
But I mean, but even those Princess musicals aren't revived that much today.
True. Yeah, totally agree. Yeah.
You really, when you get back to, I mean, I think the musical the earliest musical that gets revived today would be Showboat.
To an extent, but
I mean, you know, by a majority of companies. I'm not saying that nobody ever does anything before 1927.
Right.
I think that really is the start of what most people consider the American musical. Miller and Lyles are the subject of this drawing. They were the stars of the show. but did white audiences sort of recognize Miller and Lyle as sort of this creative team that, oh, it's a Miller and Lyle show, so it's going to be better or worse, or expect something of it because it was Miller and Lyle's, or was that just, they were just black entertainers?
I don't know if I have a direct question. I mean, a direct answer for that. I do think, based on what I've read, I do think there was an added element because it was Miller and Lyle's, because they had Shuffle Along behind them.
Right.
So anytime that it's Miller and Lyle's, these are the guys that created this wave of black, or, you know, created in the words of commentators,
right,
created this wave of black musicals. So, and everyone's, you know, until Blackbirds of 28 comes along, everyone's comparing black musical theater to Shuffle Along.
Right.
So there is the Miller and Lyle's element, I think, for sure. At the same time, though, I don't think it was like, you know, I'm trying to think.
They weren't the Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Like, oh, Eddie Dowling's going to be starring in this, or yeah, Eddie Cantor's, you know, coming into, you know, Eddie Cantor's coming into town and Whoopi. You know, I don't think they attained that sort of,
right,
that level. But I do think there was the extra element of them having been the sort of originators of the 20s black musicals with Shuffle Along.
And did black audiences come to black musicals on Broadway in the 20s?
To an extent, yes. It's primarily white audiences.
Right, I would assume.
But I think to an extent, yes. And to black plays as well, because I know we're going to just address this later, but they did. I mean, to what, you know, what percentage did they make of the audience? I don't know the answer offhand, and I suspect it's very small.
Right.
But they
would have been segregated. I mean, they would have had to.
Well, I mean, technically, no, because there was, I'm forgetting the exact year, but there was passed a municipal law, civic law, I forget the technical word, which prohibited segregation in theaters in New York.
Really?
This was like late 1800s, very end of the 1800s.
Did not know that.
However, to what extent that was enforced, I don't know, because they're actually episodic articles that I've read about black patrons who, there's one specific, I cannot remember the show that he was going to see, but this is the early teens, so it would have been before this period, in fact, when he bought a ticket, an orchestra seat, to a Broadway show, you know, totally fine, and then he shows up at the theater with his seat, and they won't let him sit in the seat. They tell him either you have to leave the theater or sit in the balcony. So, which would have was illegal, and then the gentleman had the theater manager arrested. That scenario. So technically they would not have been segregated. To what extent that was enforced and what happened, I think probably a different story.
Wow. Right. I wanted to get some sense of how these musicals were viewed during that time. And to some extent, Hirschfeld is sort of he's raising the flag about how people would see them. You know, they were the important figures. So Miller and Lyle's are drawn. Now, whether he got the assignment to draw Miller and Lyle's or whether he got the assignment to draw Rangtang, we don't know.
I'm just
curious as to what he chose and what was the world that he would have gone to see these shows. So what was the world that he would have seen?
Well, also, a question to you, and also on this particular topic, it's, I think, noteworthy, as you point out, that Miller and Lyle's was his first African-American drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is a question which will also support the idea, I think, of their significance. I saw, it's not in the exhibit, but there's also a Hirschfeld drawing of Ethel Waters in Africana, which opened the same year. And she was a huge performer at that time. I should say, you know, on the rise.
Right.
And that actually opened the same, that opened, Africana actually opened a day before Rangtang, although the drawing came out a year later. But,
right. And there's a lot of references in the reviews to each other's show. I mean, in Rangtang reviews, they often mention Africana. Just as, you know, the latest show. I find it interesting on the Hirschfeld end of things that in both of these, in the drawing of Ethel Waters and Africana, and of course Miller and Lyles, he does a different style of drawing, a drawing that to me is very modern. It uses cubism as a way of sort of showing their color without necessarily giving them black faces.
Yeah,
really, and I think he was.
It's really the only two drawings that he does that in.
Right, exactly. There are elements that show up in other drawings like that, but these are the only drawings.
And it's like in a hat or something in other drawings.
Right.
And so for him to do it, it's really, which is why we love the drawing so much.
I think the way he does these drawings is a sign of the modernism in his work. He was sort of giving a nudge and a wink to modernism in these drawings as much as he's giving a nod and a wink to Miller and Lyles, is my feeling.
I have a question. Based on what you just said, at what point did he move into ultimately the and forgive me, I'm not of the art world, so I can't use the proper terminology.
That's all right. That is all right.
But at what point did it move from the Africana, Miller and Lyles, even the Swing and the Dream photo, which I know is not a drawing, which is not in the exhibit,
right,
into the more linear, their line sort of which I think starts appearing in the 40s, if I'm recalling.
Well, no, he's working in line almost from the beginning, certainly with the theater work. He plays around at the beginning using additional things, like in this Rangtang drawing, he accentuates the lines with charcoal. And that's something he plays around with. I think in part he's trying to see what newspaper reproduction can do. But he's slowly taking out all the unnecessary elements of his drawings. But the decisive moment in his career comes in 32 in the island of Bali, where the sun is so bright it bleaches out all the color and all he sees are black and white line drawings walking around. And that's when as he said, his love affair with line started. And he was interested in image and pure line. He continues to do color work. He continues to routinely experiment with all different approaches. But what we consider the classic Hirschfeld style really synthesizes right around then. And, you know, he's a product of non-Western influences much more. Here's this very American artist whose influences were from the East. African art played as much of a role in his development as Japanese woodcuts and whatnot. This was not a man who came from the American illustration tradition. He much, much different story. You know, the man who introduces him to caricatures, the Mexican artist Miguel Covarrubias. So he brings all that to the work before you ever see any line of the elements of of sort of white culture.
Interesting.
All right.
Just one other mention. When you were asking about white audiences and the influence of Miller and Lyles, there I haven't dug into it, so I'm speaking only superficially at this moment.
We're good at that.
brilliant.
Yeah.
There is reference to Amos and Andy picking up stuff from Miller and Lyles.
Yes.
So there's,
I read that
so
too.
So there is that connection, which I have not explored, so I can't really speak to what extent it was, but I did see reference to that.
I think, in fact, that Miller eventually sues Amos and Andy over essentially taking their act. I don't know what the resolution of that was, but I think it's very telling that Miller thought, wow, that's so close to what we did. You probably took it from us. So I think it gives us a sense of what they're, what their act might have been like.
And it's just
because we listen to Amos and Andy today, and of course they're appalled. But again, we're bringing 21st century viewpoint to something that happened over 100 years ago.
All right. Well, let's close the door on Rang Tang, unfortunately.
Oh, my God. We could do a whole show on Rang Tang.
Yeah.
We might have just done a whole show on Rang Tang. I'm not sure. So let's talk about some of the dramas that are in here, these early dramas, starting with the Voodoo Macbeth. That's the Federal Theater Project, who, to the government's credit, realized that there should be a Negro unit as much as there should be any other unit. And this, this young man, 20-year-old Orson Welles, convinces the powers that be that they should do a Macbeth with an all-black cast. And he simply replaces medieval Scotland with 19th century Haiti. And they really, the script is unabridged. I mean, it's a remarkable production that becomes a hit. I mean, I don't think anybody imagined that. But it becomes a hit and it tours the country. I think certainly it's the first time most audiences see black performers performing Shakespeare. But what an unusual situation. And one of the stars of that show was a young actor by the name of Canada Lee, who you just mentioned before. And the drawings that we sort of grouped together all have Canada Lee in them. It's Macbeth, Native Son, and Anna Lou Costa. Can you tell us anything about Canada Lee?
I find him interesting, deeply interesting, just his career trajectory. And actually, it is not dissimilar from, which I think we're going to reference Golden Boy later, but his initial career is not dissimilar from the Odette's original Golden Boy in terms of violinist prize fighter.
Right.
Because he did, he originally studied violin, which is so interesting, with Rosamund Johnson, who we mentioned. But I guess for me, what struck me about him and what I really appreciated was just the diversity of his activities. Jockey, fighter, violinist. He starts a band. He runs a nightclub.
Right.
Then he is out of money. So as you mentioned, the Federal Theater Project. So he is in line at the Harlem YMCA and stumbles into this Federal Theater Project rehearsal and then becomes, involved. It's an interesting career, and I think the projects that he chose and or were offered are especially interesting. I one of the most fascinating discoveries about him was his use of whiteface on Broadway.
Tell me about that.
I'm going to, I think, mispronounce the title, but it's The Duchess of Malfi, uh-huh. Elizabethan drama, or I should say thriller, as it was described, which he was not supposed to do, actually. They were in Boston, I want to say, but they were out of town, and their lead actor left the show.
Now, is this the Federal Theater Project, or is
not Federal Theater? No, okay. Commercial Broadway in the mid 40s. I think this was circa 46.
Okay.
The producer, whose wife was the star of the show, they were looking for actors, and then I cannot remember how they came across Canada Lee, but they thought, he'd be great and we'll put him in whiteface. So he did this, performance in whiteface, which, is just was obviously controversial.
Yo, I bet.
At the time. but I just, in terms of what he chose to do, I think is so exciting and interesting, not just here, but in throughout his career.
Right.
And, you know, and then I think off the success of this, he then went to, or wanted to do, and it never materialized, a Shakespeare rep of Othello and Macbeth. Macbeth being in whiteface, and Othello being in his natural
Wow.
Which, and that didn't materialize. He did do an Othello that never came to New York, but anyway, so I find it, you know, I find it fascinating. And then, you know, he was in vaudeville and had
what I find fascinating. Yeah, he did all those things. And when he's on tour, he's visiting schools, you know, talking about segregation and sort of racial equality. Politically active, but also community minded. You know, it's not just, he wasn't just railing against, you know, he wasn't just speaking truth to power. He was trying to educate a younger generation into what was going on. And he didn't have to do that. You know, it would have been much easier, in fact, for him, and he would have had more work, because all this progressive sort of viewpoint got him blacklisted during the McCarthy era.
Right.
You know, it would have been much smarter for him to sort of stay in his lane and act and run the restaurant and club and do all those things. And he probably would have worked steadily. But instead, he seems like he's always pushing the envelope.
I would agree with the pushing the envelope. And I think that's one of the things that I find fascinating about him, or, you know, really interesting about him, because he's doing things that you don't expect.
Right. You know. Completely forgotten today, it seems.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Which is, again, just remarkable. I mean, the three shows that we show him in were huge hits. You know, well, I mean, they were big hits. The Voodoo Macbeth was a big hit. Right. Native Son was a big hit. And he toured with that as well. And then Anna LaCosta. Those. And then he was also in plays by Saroyan. I mean, he's got a really rich career that unfortunately sort of ends prematurely because he's blacklisted.
Right. And also dies.
Well, that,
I mean, because
that's always going to hurt your career.
I don't know. According to Cher, on her David Letterman interview, she said, sometimes death can be the best thing for your career.
Right. James Dean, you know, has done very well with it.
Yeah. Good example.
Right. Not so much for a theater career, perhaps, but
right.
No. So I think it was, I want to say 1952. It was early 50s. Mm. So, you know, while he was still active, I think he was trying to get his Othello film made. And then something happened, it fell through, and then he ended up dying. I want to say 1952. It was sometime early 50s. Yeah. His career, you know, his career ended. I wonder if, it's interesting that you're mentioning we don't remember him today, but I think most people today, or there's a general consciousness of Paul Robeson.
Of course.
He's obviously started before Canada Lee. But had a similarly interesting and, you know, and I think more robust career probably than Canada Lee. But then he was, I mean, even more severely affected
by
the McCarthy era, and then disappeared for, I think, at least a decade or a couple decades. But then we start to remember him in the 70s. And so now late 60s, 70s. And so now, I mean, so he's on our consciousness to an extent more.
Well, he lives longer, and then he does fight to get his passport back. Mm-hmm. And that keeps him in the eye, and just the living longer helps. You know, if you can get past the blacklist and continue to work, you're going to have that ability for people to remember you. Whereas Kennedy Lee didn't have that. But speaking of Paul Robeson, and speaking of Othello, as we were, of course, we have that drawing in the exhibition. Right. Paul Robeson, Hirschfeld's only drawing of Robeson, in the title role of Othello, that appeared on Broadway in 1942, the longest running Shakespeare production ever presented on Broadway. He Margaret Webster was his director. Jose Ferrer was Iago.
Pioneer female director.
Yeah, pioneer. Well, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about her, because she's fascinating in her own way.
I have not done an extensive dive on her other than to become familiar with her work. Coincidentally, it was last week or the week before when I started to really look at her, right before you had emailed me. I just find her very interesting. She became well known, especially for directing Shakespeare plays.
Sure.
And so she directed, ironically or coincidentally, she directed Canada Lee in The Tempest on Broadway. Mm. This was a couple of years after the Robeson and Othello. Mm. But a fascinating woman. And I guess why she popped onto my radar was because of her association with two other really powerful women of the theater, Eva Le Gallienne Cheryl Crawford.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so the three of them were interconnected, especially throughout the 40s.
Sure.
And so, you know, it's they're just, you know, they're three mammoth creatures, you know, and Margaret Webster, yeah. being principally a director, Cheryl Crawford being principally a producer, and Eva Le Gallienne being principally an actress, although the three of them, you know,
they all did all the roles.
Right. So I just find them very interesting. And they had it was a couple years after the Robeson and Othello that they formed American Repertory Theater, which was led by, you know, this repertory led by three women on Broadway. Right. It was short lived, but still, I think, noteworthy just for on its own, on its face, and then for the three women who are on their own noteworthy, you know.
Right.
Well,
Le Gallienne had been noteworthy. I mean, she had her own company downtown in the 20s. I mean, that may be the start of off Broadway, although I think the production of Summer and Smoke in 1952 is generally considered the start of off-Broadway. She's producing downtown in the mid-20s, doing incredible productions that were very ahead of their time. Why she didn't use Black actors, who knows? But what I find fascinating about this Othello drawing is you have four figures that just titans. You have Robeson, of course, and we talked about Webster, but you have Jose Ferrer, who is arguably the first Latinx superstar. You know, he had been on Broadway for 6 or 7 years at this point. He would go on to win a number of Tonys. He'd go and win Oscars. He would end up be a producer and a director. Really a very, very important figure. And then, the Desdemona is Uta Hagen. You know, a woman whose shadow on American acting is looms large. It is when she kisses Robeson in this production, it's the first interracial kiss on Broadway. I mean, so it's really, and she's just not at the start of her career, but she's early in it. So it's a real moment in time that is captured in this drawing, which, last year, I think it was last year, went up for auction and sold for $68,000, over $68,000, because everyone recognized that this is a real historic work.
Indeed.
Yeah. Go ahead.
This is a backtrack, but on Robeson and Othello and sort of the interracial element. I was interested to discover that he had done Othello in London in 1930.
Right.
And specifically did not want to do it in America because of the reaction or the hostility that he felt it would have faced at that time.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting. And of course, this is this is after he's playing an interracial relationship in O'Neill's All God's Chilling Got Wings.
Sure.
And there, you know, it's just, I guess it just, it Jones. Speaks to the time is rather interesting.
Well, and I think it's also telling that that is exactly what he's thinking about when after the national tour, City Center wants him to do, they want to bring the show into City Center, which is really just getting on its feet. He doesn't want to do it because he feels like I got good reviews the first time. I don't want to give him another shot at me. And it's LaGuardia who convinces him it's his duty, it's civic duty to play this production for a $2 top ticket, which was a very cheap ticket at that time. And fortunately for all involved, critics still feel the exact same way about the production. And it's a big hit for City Center. It's a big hit for Robeson and for everybody involved.